Meanwhile, have a most enjoyable and restful end to your weekend, and I hope you can join me, James Jolly, next Sunday, same time, same place. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3, with studio production today by Lyndon Jones.
On The Choir today, it's time to turn our attention to the BBC Singers, the UK's only professional full-time choir. As singers, we're given new repertoire every 3 to 4 days, and the standard required and set by this choir is very high. I'm Rebecca Lodge, and with my co-presenter Neil McKenzie, we'll be chatting about our work as members of the BBC Singers and its incredible history, working with composers such as Pierre Boulez and Francis Poulenc. So do join us on The Choir this afternoon at 5 o'clock, only here on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's just coming up to 12 noon. As part of our British music series here, Michael Barclay's guests on Private Passions this month are leading poets from across the country. Today, the Newcastle poet, Sean O'Brien.
Sean O'Brien is an ideal poet for this programme, since he conjures up musical landscapes in his writing. And for that writing, he's won many prizes, the T.S. Eliot, the Somerset Maugham, and three times over, the Forward Poetry Prize. He's also written short stories and a novel, and translations from Dante and the classics. And he's currently Professor of Creative Writing at Newcastle University. However, Sean, something which your readers may not know about, what you might call a dark secret, is that for a couple of years you were a drummer in a rock band.
I'm not convinced the other members of the band would have seen it quite that way. But I was there endeavouring to play the drums at the back, and I loved it, but I was not good at it. I could see what needs to be done, but I couldn't do it. And the others went on to be professional musicians, and I sensibly got a proper job. But it was great. I loved it.
There's nothing quite like that feeling of playing in a band, making people move.
Yes, occasionally it would work. And, you know, we'd be playing in pubs and that kind of thing, an occasional prison visit as well. Mm-hmm. And occasionally it really worked. And it is exciting. It's a sort of collective pleasure.
It is quite hard work, because you didn't presumably have roadies. You had to hump it all around yourself.
No, we're always carrying the damn stuff up and downstairs. You know, and
I remember.
And also, bands are terrible thieves. You know, they nick each other's mic stands and amps and anything else they can carry away.
One thing that strikes me about your poetry, I was talking about the musicality of it. You were brought up in Hull and you're settled now in Newcastle. And the poems, it seems to me, do actually have the sounds of the northeast, the cries of gulls, shunting of trains, rain, river.
Yes, well, I grew up on the north bank of the Humber in Hull, which is about 20 miles inland, but it used to be a very big fishing port. It has a marine feel to it, so there's that. There's a lot of water, and as you say, a lot of gulls, and it's very flat, and there were used to be lots of trains shunting about in that very flat landscape. So all those sounds really work their way in. The water, the trains, you know, the repetitive awfulness of the weather, they all work their way into the texture of the poems, I guess, you know. But they're there partly as devices to transport the poems somewhere to a kind of parallel version of the north, where the imagination lives, you know, which is next door to the one we're actually occupying.
Englishness and the concept of Englishness has come into your writing a lot. And the first song you've chosen is a Vaughan Williams song, a quintessential writer of English song, Vaughan Williams. I have trod the upward and downward slope.
Yes, I think it's a stoical song. It's a song about certain kinds of accomplishment, but uttered without vanity. When I was listening to it again before coming here today, I thought, this is like a grown-up version of My Way. That it affirms the value of experience without being insistent about it. It merely says, this is what I've done, what I've undergone, what I've seen, you know, and I've been fortunate. I have lived and loved, as the lyric ends.
You know. You asked me to choose a recording for you, and a singer I know and admire very much, in fact have worked with, is Roderick Williams. Ian Burnside's playing the piano here.
toward the upward and the downward slope. I have endured and done in days before. I have longed for all and bid farewell to hope. And I have lived and loved. And
I Have Trod the Upward and the Downward Slope by Vaughan Williams. Roderick Williams was the singer and the pianist was Ian Burnside. And incidentally, that song was an epilogue to the cycle Songs of Travel. Your poems, Sean O'Brien, often conjure up memories of your 50s childhood by the sea. There's a very evocative sequence called The Railway Sleeper, where you're recording, composing, I suppose, the sounds you hear lying in bed as a child. And I wondered if you might read us that.
Yes, this is from a series of prose poems. And this is the sixth section. I'm lying in bed when the train goes by. On summer nights, that blue sound, like remembering an unlived life. And another, audible here at the triangle's centre. Promises, promises. The fulfilment of desire on the chilly evening sands of far-off resorts, where the fathers parade with their shirt collars flattened on their lapels, and the mothers say, "It's getting on, Ted," and you suppose it is, though you're not Ted, you're you, just listening. Cacophonous plumbing awaits you, the sexual creak, the fart of unbuttoned self-regard, the sound of waves, of trains, the silence of the blue night that frames them.
I like the unbuttoned self-regard. More about trains later. The next choice is very contrasting.
Yes, it's Prokofiev's music for Eisenstein's film Alexander Nevsky. And it's film music, which I'm often told is supposed to be inferior to concert music. But I just love the cinema, and I suppose I really became addicted to it when I was about 14, when it became almost legal at school not to play sport on Wednesday afternoons. You know, if you were not to be seen, you could get off the premises and you could go into town and see whatever was on at the cinema, you know, from masterpieces such as Alexander Nevsky to terrible spy thrillers of the period and carry-on films and dreadful old Edgar Wallace B pictures and awful, awful Italian sword and sandal epics dubbed by lunatics, presumably at Delane Lee round the corner from the studio.
We used to go round the corner and see Naked as Nature Intended, which was a Swedish theatre.
That was a sort of education, and terrible westerns, and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of films, which really furnish your mind inescapably afterwards.
So this is the film music that Prokofiev wrote for Eisenstein's epic recreation of the 13th century battle on the ice, and in fact the famous scene where the massive Teutonic knights are crossing the lake and ice cracks appear, and the army is drowned. I had a look at it on YouTube. It's a thrilling passage. Mm-hmm. You like listening to that music full blast. It's certainly full blast music, isn't it?
Yes. It's Gergiev conducting it. It is quite frightening music.
Actually, funny enough, Gergiev agrees with you because he said it's probably the best piece of film music ever written.
Right, yeah.
And he was conducting the Kirov Orchestra and Chorus of the Mariinsky Theatre in St. Petersburg, part of the score for Eisenstein's film Alexander Nevsky by Prokofiev. All the details, by the way, of today's recordings are on the Private Passions website. So, Sean, you spent part of your youth in the cinema, perhaps when you shouldn't have done, but you started, I think it was about 14 when you began to write poems.
Yes, a long time ago now, back in the summer of 1967, we had a great English teacher, Mr. Grayson. Thank you, Mr. Grayson, who came in one day with some early poems by Eliot, The Preludes and Proof Rock, and some early poems by Ted Hughes. And life changed in the course of the English lesson, really. It's just simply the most interesting thing I'd ever experienced, and it was clear that there was no other serious way to spend my life.
I'm constantly struck by how there's often just one pivotal person in a child's education who enthuses with them and gives them the key to the door which unlocks their future.
Well, I was very fortunate in that my parents are very encouraging of my interests. So, you know, there were books at home, so that was good. But, yes, somebody just happens along at the right moment and also doesn't simplify things. Somebody who allows things to be as difficult and strange as they are. That's quite important in teaching, I think.
After that, you went on to Cambridge then to study English.
Mm.
And I think the next music dates from those days.
This is Little Feet, led by the wonderful and sadly long-departed Lowell George, singing Spanish Moon, a kind of a fantasia of male eroticism crossed with music, crossed with drink and drugs. It's absolutely perfect of its kind. But what I really like about it is the drumming of, again, the late lamented Richard Hayward, who manages to make something that could be very statuesque, he manages to make it swing.
Drummers that indulged in all those things you just mentioned don't tend to last long, so maybe it's just as well you moved over to poetry.
Just the same.
You can lose it all down at the Spanish Moon. Whiskey and bad cocaine, poison get you just the same. And if that don't kill you soon, the women will down at the Spanish Moon.
A consummation devoutly to be wished.
I love that fat bass guitar too.
Yes, very unusual. They were unusual. They were becoming unusual at the time that they were a multi-ethnic band. There's three white guys and two black guys, and that tended not to happen much after the mid-70s. Kenny Gradney on the bass.
Little Feat's Spanish Moon, that recording from 1974. One of those long summers when you were a student. Now, you became, I think, in your 30s, when you were making your living as a poet for the first time, addicted to Debussy.
Yes.
And in particular, La Mer.
Addicted to Debussy in general for a period. Well, my justification for it is that I was looking for an equivalent in musical experience for some of the things that happen in symbolist poetry. And that kind of intense late romanticism of Debussy is very appealing to, well, to this poet, I think. The creation of states of mind, the ability to suspend time, or to produce, you know, vast dramatic effects, which is characteristic of La Mer, but also L'Après-midi d'enfant, I listen to a great deal, and piano music like the Isle of Joy.
I'm fascinated you say that, Sean, because you know, people used to say to Debussy, "Oh, you're the musical equivalent of Impressionism," and he hated that. He said, "If you want to know what I look like, look at Turner," which of course is much more dramatic.
Yes. It's not pretty. I mean, it can be very beautiful, but it's also, it's strange, it stretches, and it is a sort of analogue to poetry. I mean, he was interested in poetry. I think he was interested in Mallarmé and so on. And it's where the two arts, poetry is always envious of music, because that's what poetry wants to be, whereas music has no need to be poetry, you know, so we're always following in the wake of music. But the two come quite close in sensibility here, it seems to me.
And to get that feeling of the sort of violence of a storm at sea, he actually went out in a boat onto the English Channel to experience it, and actually nearly got drowned.
Yeah, well, that's a bit like the death of Louis McNeice by going down a pothole to do some research for a play about caves and getting pneumonia and dying. You know, it's, I think you should rely on your imagination. I'm not in favour of taking risks like that.
Well, this is the dialogue between the wind and the sea from Debussy's La Mer. What do you feel hearing that again?
Well, it's exhilarating. I realise music is a means of attaining temporary ecstasy, as far as I'm concerned. But also, I feel a bit guilty as if music shouldn't be quite so enjoyable to listen to, you know? The extraordinary range of colours in that, you know? It's too pleasurable, you know? It's too Catholic. It needs some kind of Protestant restraint applying to it.
But he was such a craftsman, too. He gets so much... from so little, in a sense. You think of that little tune, da-dee, and then back up a whole tone, dee-dee, and yet he milks that to make something colossal.
Yes. In a way, that's something that jazz musicians do as well, is to take a riff and unpack it.
Take a line for a walk.
Yeah, yeah.
The third section of Debussy's La Mer, the dialogue between the wind and the sea, Bernard Haitink there was conducting the Concertgebouw Orchestra. I think in the music we're going to hear next, you feel that the lyrics are just about as good as they get. It's Ella Fitzgerald's Too Marvellous for Words.
Yes, I think any poet would envy the crispness, the clean lines of this, and the wit and invention. A song which is about the inadequacy of language, which somehow trumps language itself. So it's a very sophisticated piece of work, but it's also down at what Auden would have thought of as the kind of light end of the spectrum. And he thought poets should be able to write comic songs, cabaret songs, and move over to grand tragedy and back. And I agree with him. We should be able to use all the forms at our disposal. And I think as a popular song, there's very little that is superior to this.
Stand by, amorous. It's all too wonderful. I'll never find the words that say enough, tell enough. I mean, they just aren't swell enough. You're much too much, and just too very, very too ever be in Webster's dictionary. And so I'm borrowing a love song from the birds to tell you that you're marvelous, too marvelous for words.
That's the Johnny Mercer Richard Whiting number, Too Marvellous for Words, Ella Fitzgerald, and an arrangement, of course, by Nelson Riddle. We've mentioned trains and the sound of trains. Why do you think you're so fascinated by them and that they play such an important part in your writing?
Well, they were always there in the background in childhood, as for many people. You know, you'd hear trains going by in the distance, and I seem always to have lived in a sort of, you know, the centre of a triangle of different railway lines. So there's always something to be hearing, and that remains the case now, living in Newcastle. But when I started doing a lot of poetry readings, because poets notoriously can't drive, and I'm of that party, I go by train, which means I see the landscape and gradually begin to absorb it into the poems, and it feeds my imagining of England, you know, this Platonic England, which is sort of just next door, just out of sight, and the train is a means of access to it. It's a temporary ecstasy. It's a way also of travelling in time, I think, because you see that England is not all current. Quite a lot of England is still in 1958, and some of it's in 1947, and that's interesting in itself. So it's an imaginative device in itself, the train. I think it's the most, next to the book, probably the greatest thing ever invented. They're a kind of temporary access to Eden, you know, to the sphere of the possible. And poets are very envious also of train films. You know, the great Hitchcock version of The 39 Steps has significant elements on a train, and the first version of The Lady Vanishes is much more interesting for what Hitchcock does with trains and bits of footage knitted together and model making and so on. The whole artifice of it is much more interesting than the story, I would suggest, or so it seems to me.
And, of course, Night Mail, the collaboration between Orton and Britton, is a wonderful conjuring up in poetry and music of a train.
Yes, I mean, that's almost a kind of secular hymn on the subject of trains, isn't it? It's become, as very few modern poems do, it's become common cultural property. It's one that people know and turn to and like. I rather wish that Flanders and Swann's The Slow Train were as popular, because I think it's just as beautiful in its way.
In fact, it's Steve Reich whose trains you're going to indulge, isn't it?
Yes, I'm not quite sure why I like this. I think I like the voices a lot, the voices snatched, as it were, out of the air of people making remarks or making station announcements, and also, obviously, the sense of movement and the way in which Reich is quite happy, it seems, to let mechanisms be mechanical. You know, he doesn't need to humanise them, which is interesting, because my view is quite different, quite anti-scientific.
This is very much collage of sounds, I think, and memories from childhood, journeys between Reich's mother and father who were separated, but also thinking possibly about the fact that had he lived in Europe and not America, he might have been travelling on trains which transported Jews to concentration camps.
Yes, when the music moves over to Europe, somehow in it there is a lamentation and a sense of the ominous as well.
Crack train from New York. to Los Angeles. From New York to Los Angeles. From New York to Los Angeles. From New York to Los Angeles. From New York. From New York to Los Angeles. From New York.
Part of Different Trains by Steve Reich, the Kronos Quartet there. Fascinating idea to take little snippets of real interviews and then not just simply play them, but actually edit them in such a way that they duplicate themselves and become refrains.
Yes, they take on an unintended life, you know, sort of an eloquent moment, and it's as much to do with the intonation of the speaker as the words themselves, I think. I happen to like this piece by Steve Reich. I'm not sure what I would do if I had a warehouse full of it.
Might go mad.
It's possible. Or I might run away on a train. But it's something that, you know, people who grew up with popular music, grew up with rock and roll, are inured to repetition. It doesn't trouble us in quite the same way as it might people whose education was primarily in classical and romantic music.
I think one of the reasons that people like Philip Glass, Michael Nyman, Steve Reich have become very popular is that it's very close to the aesthetic of pop music, mm-hmm. the repetition thing, which means that it is a kind of popular music. Fascinating how these things develop. We're going to go back now to an earlier time and Die Stadt, a late Schubert song. Why did you want this?
Well, I first heard this material while recording years ago a kaleidoscope for Radio 4, and the singer, Boye Skohus, as I think he's pronounced, was there talking about the record, and they played some of it. I'd never heard a voice so beautiful, so that it was in the first place for his voice. But I liked the song a great deal, Heine's extremely focused gloom and the sense of imminence and being foredoomed is very, very appealing, especially if you're sitting in a comfortable room listening to it on headphones, you know, feeling doomed, but only in the aesthetic sense. ¶¶
The way it just trails off there. Schubert's haunting song, Die Stadt, published in 1829, just a few months after his death, sung there by Boya Skohus, with Helmut Deutsch playing the piano. I think you said, and I rather like this about your work, Sean, that it's either grimly humorous or just grimly grim.
That seems to be the case, yeah. You can have any colour as long as it's grim.
But there's often a sense of humour running through it, even if it's, as you say, rather dark.
Yes, and the humour is often a humour of exasperation, I think.
And talking of that, you don't terribly enjoy going to concerts, do you?
Do I not?
You're not mad about the audiences?
Well, I don't like going to the theatre all that much, because it's as if there emanates from the mass audience an extraordinary disquiet and self-consciousness, or so it seems to me, which I find very distracting. If I were allowed to go and see the play by myself in a darkened room, you know, it would be better. But from a social point of view, it's much better if I stay at home and everybody else enjoys themselves. But I just... And similarly, at music events, I often find the audience itself is a distraction from the thing, which sounds a very deathly thing to say, as if I'm opposed to life, but I just find it distracting.
We're going to finish on a more cheerful note, because you're going to describe the soundtrack to your Sunday mornings, and indeed the Sunday mornings themselves.
Well, Sunday morning ideally would be spent... my partner, Jerry, she and I would spend it sitting in the back room with the dogs, reading the papers and eating various bits of breakfast, drinking coffee and thinking vaguely of doing something with the day but not having committed ourselves to it. And we'd probably listen to music, which might well include Ella Fitzgerald, but it would very likely, if I was allowed to put it on, would be Cannonball Adderley and Miles Davis playing Autumn Leaves.
Well, I think we might play out on that and that lovely vision of the dogs reading the papers. Thank you very much, Sean O'Brien, for sharing your private passions with
pleasure.
Us. Thank you.
Miles Davis's Autumn Leaves, ending this week's edition of Private Passions, in which Michael Barclay was talking to the poet Sean O'Brien. Michael's guest next week will be another poet, the poet laureate, in fact, Carol Ann Duffy. And you may like to know that there's now a weekly download of Private Passions available. Just visit the programme's page on the Radio 3 website for details. This week's edition of Private Passions was produced by Elizabeth Burke and is a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3. Hello, I'm John Shea. Welcome to this Sunday afternoon on BBC Radio 3. In just a minute, the news followed by the early music show. First, though, a word from Sarah Walker.
Celebrating British music on BBC Radio 3. Throughout the month of June, Essential Classics is broadcasting a series of 20 great British works. At 11 o'clock every weekday during June, Rob Cowan and I will be introducing a celebrated recording of a celebrated British work by composers such as Tallis, Elgar, Delius and Britten. Hear our choice and have your say. Great British works and Essential Classics, weekday mornings 9 until 12 on BBC Radio 3.
And in fact, the work that Rob Cowan will be playing tomorrow morning is William Byrd's Mass for Four Voices in the recording recommended by Simon Hayes in yesterday's Building a Library. Tune in at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning for that here on BBC Radio 3. More music by William Byrd in the early music show with Catherine Bott in a couple of minutes. But now at 1 o'clock, here's the latest BBC news. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has said allegations that the intelligence services circumvented the law to gather data on British citizens are nonsense. GCHQ has been accused of monitoring emails, photos and videos from material gathered by an American agency. Mr. Hague confirmed that he'll give a statement to Parliament on the allegations tomorrow. A senior Conservative MP, Tim Yeo, has denied claims that he used his position as chairman of a Commons committee to help a private company influence Parliament. Mr. Yeo was secretly filmed by reporters from the Sunday Times. The paper alleges that the former Environment Minister coached the boss of a firm before the businessman gave evidence to the committee. Mr. Yeo has referred himself to the Parliamentary Standards Watchdog. Police are treating an overnight fire at an Islamic boarding school in London as suspicious. More than 120 pupils and staff were moved from the Darul Uloom school in Chislehurst late on Saturday night. Two men were treated for smoke inhalation. At least 27 people have been killed and more than 70 wounded in the Libyan city of Benghazi in clashes between protesters and a militia allied with government forces. The violence broke out when protesters gathered outside the headquarters of the Libya Shield Brigade, demanding that it be disbanded. North and South Korea have held their first official talks in more than 2 years. Officials met at a village on the border to discuss plans for a ministerial-level gathering. Prayers have been said at churches in South Africa for the country's former president, Nelson Mandela, who spent a second night in hospital with a lung condition. Mr. Mandela is breathing unaided and he remains in a serious but stable condition. Tennis and the men's final of the French Open gets underway in an hour's time. Rafael Nadal is bidding to become the first man to win the same Grand Slam title, singles title 8 times. He's playing his fellow Spaniard, David Ferrer. And the weather. The warmest and sunniest of it will be in the west, but a few showers may develop in northwestern Britain. Maximum temperatures of around 18 degrees for Celsius, although there'll be just 13 degrees in some eastern coastal areas. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 1:02. So now it's time for the early music show. And today, Catherine Bott's second of this weekend's programmes, celebrating the life and music of William Byrd.
Shame thy mother's grief, born as I die. Alfred Deller with the Wenzinger Consort performing William Byrd's Come, Pretty Babe to begin our second instalment of this celebratory pair of early music shows commemorating William Byrd, the great Renaissance English composer. With me again is Andrew Carwood, Director of Music at St Paul's Cathedral in London and also Founder Director of the Cardinal's Music. Welcome back, Andrew. Now, this is a fascinating pair of vocal items from William Byrd that we're going to hear, and you've got a story about the one we've just heard and the next one that connects them.
I won't claim responsibility for the story. It's John Harley who suggested it as a possibility, another one of the great Byrd researchers. You just heard a lullaby, essentially, albeit a slightly sad one about a deserted mother, which is, you know, is often the way with lullabies. That can be about quite difficult subjects. And the piece that is going to follow is one of Byrd's madrigals, Lullaby My Sweet Little Baby, which is very clearly about the Christ child and the difficulties of getting him to sleep with all the nastiness that will be going on around in his life. But John Harley has suggested that both of these pieces might have been written for the birth of one of Byrd's children, possibly Thomas, in 1576. Byrd doesn't seem very often to write things which are relevant to his family or to his life in any way, but these two, it's thought, might fall into that category, which would be rather lovely.
And he was happily married for many a long year and sired several children, didn't he?
Yes, I always have to remind myself not to be too romantic about these things. He was married for a long time. I hope it was happy. We have no empirical evidence to that effect. But yes, I mean, it was a long relationship. And yes, there were children, and there doesn't seem to have been too much trouble. I mean, his wife gets more censures for being a Catholic, by the by, I should say, in passing, than Byrd does. And they still stay together, so they must have loved each other quite a lot.
Let's agree that they did, yes. And let's hear Lullaby, My Sweet Little Baby.